Well, welcome to DougHammock.com and to this current podcast project on rethinking sexual education. Studies are breaking the bad news to religion and, for our purposes, to the Christian church, that the way that we teach sexuality is not informing the sexual behaviors of our young people. If we think that the wisdom of our heritage has something valuable to give them as they go about exploring and directing their sexual energies, well, what we're doing now isn't working. So each week, I post a podcast episode to help get the conversation started. And then I hope to get us thinking together about hammering out a viable curriculum for sexually training our young people. So join in and comment, either on the blog page or on the Facebook page, and feel free to disagree. Maybe advocate for restraint or push the envelope. At the end of the project, I'll turn what we learned together into a book, and I'd love to have your input into the process. So let's begin this week's episode titled, Sex. It's More Than Penises and Vaginas. Now, in our last episode of the podcast, we spoke of the five institutions that make up every society and how all but one have their hands tied behind their backs when it comes to sexually training our young people. Government and education are hamstrung by politics. Religion has lost its voice, lost its moral authority. The family is overburdened by social and economic factors, so only our economic systems are hard at work hammering out a comprehensive curriculum for directing our sexual energies. And their objective is to sell stuff. Now, to do it, they exploit the most evocative part of sexuality, the visual impact of push-up bras and six-packs. They show tender and embracing images of happy people swept up in romance and laughter. Marketers tap into our deep physical and emotional yearnings in the hope of awakening strong feelings, feelings that hopefully then they can transfer to their products. But when a capitalist sex sells system of economic distribution is the dominant voice drumming out our society's curriculum of sexual training, we have to know that their interest is not in creating a comprehensive understanding of how sexuality works. No, not at all. Theirs is a much more limited objective. Theirs is to create powerfully evocative and sexual feelings and then attach them to a product. So, they appeal to our sexual desire to be with and to be beautiful people, sexy people, cellulite-free, healthy and fit people. They appeal to our desire to be in the throes of emotional and physical fulfillment, engaging in lingering and adoring gazes. It's all very passionate and it's all very stimulating and it's all very right now. It awakens the sexual energy of yearning and wanting, and when this is the dominant drumbeat of sexual training in our culture, well, of course, our young people pick up the sense that this is what sex is. It's visual, it's evocative, it's immediate, it's about getting what we want from another person. And if you do this, or if you buy that, or if you trim down that, or if you pump up that, well, then you can satisfy that deep human hunger, which would be great if human sexuality worked that way. But as powerful as the feelings that our marketers evoke are, they only scratch the surface of our sexuality. Sitting in an outside cafe recently, a friend told me a story about awakening to a much deeper version of sexuality. He told the story with great passion, and I was moved, but it's a story I've heard many times. It could just as easily have been a she as a he. He could have been one of scores of people who have told me some iteration of this story. I was young, he began, and I was footloose and fancy free, and I had a great job, and I was making a lot of money. I made all the shrewd purchases, so I had all the best stuff that a good job can buy. I went to all the right places at all the right times, and I met all the right women, and they were happy to go out with me, and they were happy to go to bed with me. And so I was having lots and lots and lots of sex. It was every American male's dream, and I was working the plan. I figured you only get one spin at life, and the point is to grab everything you can, so I was chasing orgasms, and of course, I believed I was chasing love. And it was great until it wasn't great anymore. You know the old saying, I was looking for love in all the wrong places. It was easy to get women to go to bed with me, and I was doing it so much that after a while, the thrill that had once been began to slip away. You know the B.B. Keene song, the thrill is gone. Yeah, it was that. So I did what people do when their drug of choice stops giving them what it once gave them. I upped the dose. I began to chase the dragon. I got more women, more beautiful women, more frequent women. I had curvy women. I had straight up and down women. I had blonde women, brunette women, natural women, shaved women. And I was doing it all, and I was doing it often. But you know how chasing the dragon goes, Doug, he said. At some point, you hit the limits of tolerance. You hit the end of the line. I hit the last stop on the slippery slope of diminishing returns. And I realized that more wasn't making me any happier, not at all, because the thrill was gone. It got so bad, he said, that at one point I really began to wonder if I was gay. What's wrong with me? I thought, this is the dream. This is what everybody wants, and I have it. And I have to tell you, he said, it became a pretty dark time. And it stayed dark for a good long time. I quit going out. I got off the treadmill, and I stayed off of it for a while. Then, without really trying to, I met the woman who's now my wife. And I was pretty wary. I was pretty disillusioned. But I decided to try and do things differently. I was raised well. I mean, I really was. And people taught me the ancient ways. I'd rejected them as old-fashioned, but I knew what they were. And somewhere in my past, I'd been taught that caring for someone was just as satisfying as being cared for by someone. Now, it wasn't an immediately intuitive concept, but what the heck, what I'd been doing, that wasn't working. Now, she is a very caring woman, so out-caring her wasn't really in the cards, but really what I did was go through a major shift in my orientation to dating. I purposely thought about her. I thought about what she needed. I thought about what things meant to her. And I realized pretty quickly that to make this shift, I had to do some growing up. I had to do some changing. Really, I had to become a better person. And as I began to work this new way of being with someone, something strange happened to me. The thrill came back. Now, don't get me wrong, she is womanly, and she is beautiful, and she is sexy, and our erotic times together, there's nothing better. But whereas that used to be the engine that drove the train, now that is behind the engine. It follows, it doesn't lead. So how did I miss that? How did I not see that the fulfillment of giving trumps the fulfillment of getting? No wonder I was bored. I didn't understand what sex was really about. This way, he said. This way, Doug, it's a whole lot better. I mean, it's a sexier kind of better. It's a deeper kind of sexy. Who knew? Now, as I said, I've heard that story a lot. The female version of the story usually wakes up to the disappointment earlier in the process, but it's the same story. When we buy the reductionist version of sexuality, it leaves us empty. When we buy the sexuality that the marketers are selling, we experience a profound sense of emptiness. We experience buyer's remorse. But our young people don't know that. They haven't had the time in their short lives to chase that dead end all the way down to ground. And when they do, it's no surprise that they too experience the dissatisfaction and the regret and the emptiness that those who've gone before them have also experienced. And if we don't give our children, our young people, the framing context that they need, we condemn them to the same kind of empty outcome. They get short bursts of intense sexual pleasure, followed by lifetimes that are really divorced from the deep relational fulfillment that we all seek. We have got to do better for our young people. Now, I think that most mature adults recognize that the way we do sex in our society is missing something. It's missing something important. There's a deep voice inside us. And if we have ears to hear it, it's telling us that the sexual fire that the advertisers depend on, that's only the very first step on a very long sexual journey. Most romantic movies, and certainly the literature that's been around for a long time, has ever after somewhere in the mix. There is something inside us that longs for and knows that there is a sexual and an erotic and a romantic and a loving way to be that has staying power. something that is still there when our sexy parts start to sag. We see couples in their 80s who have spent a lifetime learning to love one another and love one another deeply, and that speaks to a deep truth inside us. There is something in our sexual energies that draws us inexorably toward a deep and lasting connection. Something inside of us dreams of unbroken attachments, of love that lasts. I don't usually listen to country music, but one of my children does, and I imagine as musical genres go, it probably tells our stories better than most. But one of her songs goes something like this: "We believe in happy endings. We don't break, we bend instead. When things go badly, we give each other time, time to heal, time to mend. We hurt each other, sure we do. But we also believe in new beginnings. Sometimes we give in, sometimes we are given in too. Sometimes we forgive, sometimes we are forgiven. So we believe in happy endings." There's a deep interior voice that speaks to us, telling us that our sexuality is bigger than penises and vaginas. It's something even deeper than the erotic fire, something even more important than that. Now, very few people that I'm interviewing for this project or who are responding to the surveys that I'm putting out there, and especially very few young people, have been taught to channel their penis and vagina sexual energies towards something deeper, towards something more real, toward a truer place within us. Now, this podcast isn't really aimed at young people. It's aimed at the folks who want to equip our young people for healthy sexuality. So that means you're probably old enough to know who Janis Joplin was. She was asked one time what it's like to be a rock star, and her reply was instructive as we're thinking about sexuality. She said this. She said, "It's pretty hard sometimes. You go on stage and you make love to 15,000 people, and then you go home and you sleep alone." She was tapping into something that we intuitively know about our sexual energy, that it's not just about our genitals. Sexuality is also expressed in our creativity, our ability to create, not just create babies, but to create, and to create beauty and things and art and life. Our sexuality expresses our creativity. Also, our sexuality expresses an impulse that is deep inside of us to connect. Now, sometimes that impulse to connect is expressed with our genitals, but sometimes it is expressed in other kinds of connecting. The thing about the connecting impulse of our sexuality, it is that it is bigger inside of us than we give it credit for. It is an impulse that isn't satisfied until we connect widely and deeply, until we connect to everyone, until we connect to everything. In effect, our deep primal drive is like Janis Joplin's, to make love to everyone and to connect deeply to everyone, to embrace the whole universe and everything in it. That drive is inside of us, and sexuality is how that connecting drive gets expressed. At our core, we are oneness beings, not two-ness beings. We are not the discrete packages of separateness that we often think that we are. I spent a good number of pages on that in my book, Rethinking Our Story. Pick it up. It's a good read. So we have this dilemma because our sexuality expresses that oneness nature, and it yearns to be connected with everything. But we only have one body. We only have one set of genitals. We can't have an intercourse kind of connecting with everyone and with everything, which implies that our deep sexuality must be more than just hooking up the plumbing. So what a tragic reduction when we condense such a deep part of our humanity to the quick and fiery eroticism that will sell products. Now, even a reduced sexuality will still sell a billion units of toothpaste. But again, what a tragic reduction of this deep dimension of us that we experience through sexuality. Sexuality is an all-encompassing energy inside us. It is an unquenchable drive for love. It's an unquenchable drive for connectedness and community and friendship and family. It is our inner call to experience ourselves connected to the whole, not separated out as a part. It is that, but it's also our interior call to create, to make. It is that, but it is also our interior sense of immortality. And it is that, but it is also our deep sense of self-transcendence. The fiery hook-up-the-genitals drive that we all have is only one narrow aspect of a much, much larger reality. And we all intuitively know this. So why isn't that front and center in the curriculum that we use to train our young people? In his book, The Holy Longing, Ronald Rollheiser said something like this. When you see a young mother beaming with delight at her child without a thought of selfishness, that is sexuality in full bloom. A proud grandfather watching his grandson receive his diploma with eyes filled with compassion and altruism and joy, that is sexuality in full bloom. An artist, after long frustration, looking on a work with such satisfaction that everything else is blotted out, that is sexuality in its full bloom. An elderly nun who, never having slept with a man, never having been married or given birth to a child, but through years of selfless service, has a face lined deeply with compassion and love. That is sexuality in full bloom. A community gathered around a grave, consoling one another so that life can go on. Sexuality in full bloom. A table surrounded by family, with laughing and arguing and sharing life. Sexuality in full bloom. Any person, he wrote, man, woman, or child caught up in a moment of service or affection or love or friendship or compassion, having for that moment lost him or herself, is in that instant experiencing sexuality in full bloom. For centuries, our Christian tradition's sages and mystics and contemplatives have drawn a link between our sexuality and our spirituality. There are many layers to what they're pointing us toward, but most obviously we see that link when we think about procreation. Religious or not, the act of procreating, more than about anything, drives us to be imitators of the divine, what we Christians call the fruit of the Holy Spirit, love and joy and peace and patience, kindness and goodness, faithfulness and so forth. Our sexuality is an inexorable force that keeps crowding us toward these divine traits. It begins when we're drawn to one another. As we'll see later in this project, one of the things that we don't teach our young boys is how to make love to a woman. Our sex sells kind of culture teaches them to make love to a man with male instincts just in a woman's body. But when we learn to make love to another, someone who is wired differently than we are, we learn to step outside of ourselves. We learn to see the world from the perspective of the other. We learn to think about sexual pleasure and sexual foreplay and the meaning that we assign to sex. We learn to think about those things from the perspective of the other. So before procreation even starts, just as we begin learning to love the other, the process teaches us to see what the other values and teaches us to value it along with them. Again, our sexuality unremittingly crowds us towards selflessness. And then procreation creates children. And nothing has the power to break selfishness more than the jumping a fire for them kind of love that we have for our children. That surprising love that erupts in us so unexpectedly when they are born. It gives us a window into something bigger than we can contain. It is a love reality that is bigger than words. It gives us a glimpse of what divine love might mean. And that glimpse ruins us for the limited world of me and my and mine. Sexuality is spirituality. That's what we mean by bigger than just hooking up the genitals. Sex is a fire inside of us. God is a fire inside of us. Sex drives us with the creative impulse and the connecting impulse. These are the domains of the divine. Sexuality is spirituality. When we let our sexuality soar beyond the reductionist as it blooms, it swells us with the awe of the other, the delight of the other, the connectedness we share with the other. And this prison of selfishness gives way to the deep and to the divine way that is embedded deeply in us. Now, finite eroticism is not love, but it is wonderful. But given the design of things, it is often how we open the door to love, which makes our sexuality deeply spiritual. Finite eroticism is not life, but it is wonderful. But given the design of things, it is often how we open the door to life, which makes our sexuality deeply spiritual. Our sexuality is beautiful, and it is good, and it is powerful, and it is sacred, and it is given us and experienced more deeply than any other gift. It is irrepressible and overriding and uncontainable and wild, and it pushes us toward connection, not just with our sexual partner, but it pushes us toward connection with the oneness reality of this universe we live in. It pushes us toward our connectedness to and our oneness with God, our connectedness to and our oneness with each other, our connectedness to and our oneness with everything. So again, sexuality is spirituality. It drives us toward unity. It drives us toward reconciliation. And as I said earlier, we all, at some deep intuitive place inside of us, know that this is so. So why isn't sexuality's uncontainable depth front and center in the curriculum that we are using to train our young people? If we're going to prepare our children to use their sexuality well, to use their genitals well, we have to help them put eroticism into its larger context. We have to help them understand the bigger picture into which our penises and our vaginas fit. Now, young people are not context setters. That's our grown-up job. That's the gift we give to our young people. I had a comment on one of the surveys I posted on Facebook that spoke to this. The commenter said, "We can't teach our children healthy sexuality if we don't teach them healthy relationships. If we don't give them a healthy understanding of ourselves and the reality that we live in." Man, I friended that commenter right away. We can't teach our children healthy sexuality without the ancient wisdom that is wrapped around relationships and without the spirituality that is resident in that ancient wisdom around relationships. The fruit of the indwelling divine, the life of God that is ever growing in us, and the manifestation of divine life as love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness, sexuality is spirituality. So, a quick side note as we finish up here. I've been eliciting a lot of questions for this project, and most of them are really important and really practical. How shall I talk to young people about oral sex? And I think the question probably addresses the trend among young people to not think of anything outside of penetration or intercourse as real sex. Or questions come up, how do we think about masturbation, especially for girls? I got a lot of questions about how to teach young women about masturbation. Or how much porn is too much porn? And these are all really good questions, and by the way, feel free to submit your own. However, in these first several episodes, I want to lay a groundwork that gives us wide enough latitude so that we don't reduce this enormous part of our humanity down to a list of rules, which is often what Christian sexual training has done. It has said, these are the rules, this is what your body should do, and this is what your body shouldn't do. Instead, I hope to give us a framework of principles from which we can then feel equipped to hammer out some sound wisdom